Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello, everyone. I am Nick Peters, a host of the Deeper Waters podcast. I am excited to be here today because I think we've got an excellent show in store for you with a great guest. We are going to be talking today about the historical reliability of the Gospels, and my guest is the man who literally wrote the book on the historical reliability of Gospels, Dr. Craig Blomberg. Dr. Blomberg, are you there?
I am. Thank you.
Good. We had an interesting time. I remember when we were scheduling you, because I think this is your longest interview, that when I had contacted you about being on the show, you said, which hour do you want me to be on? I said, both hours.
That's right.
So, now, for my guests who might not be familiar with you, why do you think they should be listening to what you have to say today?
Well, they'll have to be the judge of that, but this is an area that I've been interested in for quite some time. I teach New Testament studies at Denver Seminary and have done so now for 27 years. Prior to that, I was a year as a senior research fellow at Tyndale House, Cambridge in England, and before that, 3 years teaching New Testament at Palm Beach Atlantic University in South Florida. But going all the way back to the very first book that I ever wrote, published in 1987, was the first edition of the Historical Reliability of the Gospels, and that's a topic that I find myself coming back to again and again, and a lot of people asking me to talk about.
Now, did you start off from a conservative position, or did you wind up finding yourself there after study? What's the story of that?
I was raised in a quite liberal wing of the old Lutheran Church in America, which subsequently merged with a couple of other Lutheran bodies, was confirmed as an eighth grader, and I can remember my young pastor in the late 1960s, fresh out of the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, where the hot topics were the death of God and liberation theology and situation ethics, existentialism, and so on, showing all us eighth graders various parallel accounts of events in the Gospels and pointing out what he believed were contradictions, but saying, don't worry about that, it's the main idea that counts. And so, no, I was not at all raised in a conservative or evangelical environment. I would probably date my coming to faith thanks to a Campus Life Youth for Christ club in my high school. But as wonderful an experience as that was, and I certainly learned a lot about the Bible, I went through my high school and college years not having a perfectly clear sense of just how reliable I thought Scripture was. And in my college years, I went to a Lutheran liberal arts college out of my church tradition that was very skeptical of more than maybe a quarter or a third of the Gospels being trustworthy. And so it really wasn't until I went to seminary at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School north of Chicago that I began to study this question intensively, hearing the best of the conservative evangelical arguments, and at that point really did become much more convinced of Scripture's trustworthiness.
Now, some people listening might recognize you from the place that I first heard of you, and I'm sure you've got this several times from some people, from reading Lee Strobel's book, The Case for Christ. And if I'm correct, did you also appear on the DVD?
That's right, yes.
Mm-hmm. So, we're here today then to talk about the historical reliability of the gospel. So, if someone has a question, they want to join in, our number, and I'll be repeating this throughout the show, is 714-242-5180. Now, why did you write this book?
I wrote it because as I was a young person trying to decide what I believed, experiencing diverse forms of Christianity, I realized that no matter what topic you might want to engage someone in a conversation about spiritual things, the Christian perspective, while it might range far and wide throughout the Bible, eventually boiled down to Jesus. And mm-hmm. who was he? And what did he teach? What did he think? What did he claim? And over again, particularly in university and higher educational circles, I found myself thinking I had a worthwhile contribution to a conversation based on the New Testament Gospels, only to receive the reply, well, of course, modern scholars have determined that Jesus never really said or did that.
Mm-hmm.
At which point, I didn't know what to say next. And so that became almost a litmus test for me. Was that claim that I kept hearing over and over again really true? And if it was, then I needed to adjust my thinking. But the more I studied, the more I looked into writings that weren't on my college professor's preferred reading lists, but were every bit as scholarly as some of them, I discovered that a very compelling case could be made, and that really was the first topic that launched my interest into academic studies of the New Testament.
You know, that's something that comes to mind when you talk about how you read the books that weren't on the recommended reading list. And I've noticed that whenever I've read liberal scholarship on the New Testament, it's very good at interacting with liberal scholarship, but not so good at interacting with the other side. When I read conservative scholarship, it interacts with both sides. Have you noticed that too, or is that just me?
Yes. I mean, you can certainly find exceptions. You can find extremely conservative writers who simply blow off anybody who disagrees with them. And you can find, I would say increasingly, since I began all of this nearly 40 years ago, you can find more liberal scholars who interact with the whole spectrum of research, but there are still plenty who don't. You're absolutely right.
It just seems that people who always say we should be open to all the evidence, strangely enough, don't seem to be open to all the evidence, much like these free thinkers who go after people who follow the method of free thinking and wind up becoming Christians.
Right. There is an irony there, to be sure.
And I've recently been reading, I read Bach's book recently, Studying the Historical Jesus, and then Dethroning Jesus, I wrote with Wallace, and now I'm reading Reinventing Jesus. There's a little pattern going on here, but
yes.
I've noticed that you are being described as a member of the Third Quest. Do you think that's an accurate label?
Yes. The quest for the historical Jesus is really a title that came to be used from a book that the famous missionary doctor and scholar Albert Schweitzer at the turn of the century, a century ago, wrote.
Mm-hmm.
describing attempts throughout the 19th century to put Jesus in his historical context, determined by historical grounds alone, who he most likely was, what kind of a figure we should think of him as. And Schweitzer himself debunked so much of those studies that there was a bit of a pause until after World War II, when a flurry of interest started what is sometimes called the new, or now the second, quest for the historical Jesus. And that started to peter out in the 70s, only to be revived in the 80s with what, as you rightly put it now, is called the third quest, that more so than ever before has really come to grips with what it means that Jesus was Jewish. It's not surprising if you think about the history of the 20th century, especially in the Western world, with two world wars, both of them involving Germany, with the horrible anti-Semitism of the Holocaust in World War II in Nazi Germany, that Christians did not always, primarily Gentile Christians, did not always appreciate just how Jewish Jesus was, nor did they really understand the full breadth of the Judaism of the first century to put Jesus up against. And so that probably more than any other single characteristic defines what now has been called the third quest.
Yeah, I've been interested a lot lately, especially with my ministry partner, Envy, social sciences, and sometimes when I read about the third quest getting back to the Jewishness of Jesus, and then I think about the social sciences getting into the Mediterranean culture of a time, I sometimes wonder, could we maybe already be in the fourth quest for the historical Jesus, or would this be considered still part of the third quest?
Well, you can divide up history in all kinds of different ways, and the people whose ideas get latched onto the most are the ones who, I guess, ultimately decide how you're going to partition it. I would think a lot of people talking about the third quest would include very much of a new interest and maybe a renewed interest in the social sciences. There is a scholar by the name of Paul Anderson who teaches at George Fox College and Seminary in Oregon, who has repeatedly called for a fourth quest, and for him what that means is that scholars really start taking the Gospel of John, which is at first blush quite different from the other three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and give it an equal say in the enterprise. Mm-hmm. And he has been a part of a lot of projects to try to help move things in that direction, and I think has made some progress. So it may be that that term has already started to be used enough that it'll get pushed in that direction.
Well, I guess history will show us where we're going to be going. But for now, we'll just talk about the historical reliability of the Gospels. Now, I know that my father-in-law, Mike Lacona, and Gary Habermas have made a big deal out, and rightly so, out of using 1 Corinthians and Galatians to make a case for a resurrection. I think we'd all agree all you need is those books, but that doesn't mean the Gospels are unimportant, and that doesn't mean we don't need to provide any case for the Gospels. Is that correct?
Right. You can go through the letters of Paul and find support for probably every statement in the Apostles' Creed, and have a very nice summary foundation of what Christians have historically believed about Jesus. Mm-hmm. And you can also come up with allusions to at least a couple of dozen or so teachings of Christ from throughout his life. But if you want anything more than that, if you want anything like a narrative in any detail of what Jesus did, then you need to go to one of the Gospels.
N.T. Wright has often talked about, and he said, I mean, it says this, he always prefaces it by saying that he admires and he delights in the creeds and thinks they're important. But he talks about how the Nicene Creed will say, we'll talk about Jesus and say, born under the Virgin Mary, crucified under Pontius Pilate. And he says, I can picture Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John sitting in the background of that saying, Yeah, we wrote a lot about that in-between stuff right there. It's somewhat important to get that, but Christians often can forget that, and what the Gospels really show us most that we can't get anywhere else really is the true life of Jesus and how he interacted with his contemporaries.
Yes, if someone had access only to the smallest amount of information about Christ, that he was an ancient Jew of the first century who was heaven sent and died an atoning death and was raised bodily from the grave, and he believed that and trusted in him, I believe that would be sufficient for that man's salvation. But if he wants anything beyond that in terms of what was this man like? What did he teach about? Mm-hmm. What were the main emphases of his ministry? Did he do amazing deeds? What else is there that we should learn about Jesus of Nazareth? Then you have to talk about something in between his birth and death.
Yeah. Now, before we go into just a little bit more, where would you say scholarship stands today overall on the Gospels? I mean, I'm sure it's not believed entirely, of course, but at the same time, I wouldn't think it's written off wholesale entirely. On average, where do most scholars stand, you think, on the Gospels?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, of course, depending on who is asking the question and who is answering it, sometimes most scholars is sort of a code word for most scholars who aren't evangelical Christians, because, of course, we know their views are biased from the start.
Of course.
And, in fact, if you look worldwide at the total number of people who have PhDs in New Testament and teach in institutions of tertiary level education, we are quickly approaching, if we have not yet already reached it, a situation where the majority of such individuals are evangelical Christians, in which case at some point one would be able to say honestly a majority of scholars believe that the Gospels are extremely reliable. But that's not usually what people are asking when they ask the question that you ask. It's, well, okay, bracket all of the believers. Now, what about everybody else? And even there is, from my perspective, a very encouraging trend over the past generation. Of course, what makes the most news, what gets picked up online and batted about, almost by definition of news, as we've come to think of it, is the most radical, the most novel, the most avant-garde, and by definition, the least likely to be true. But a silent majority, if we can borrow that term from a previous political era and apply it to biblical scholarship, is very much growing in confidence that at least the main repeated emphases and contours of the life of Jesus as found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, much less so in John, is reasonably reliable.
And even critics like Bart Ehrman say if you want to know who the historical Jesus is, the best place to go to is the four Gospels.
That's right. Now, we don't want to give him credit for saying too much by that, because he still doesn't accept a majority of what he finds there, but he recognizes that if you don't go to the Gospels, if you go to other sources, then you're likely to find almost nothing of historical value.
Well, we're talking here with Dr. Craig Blomberg. We're going to go ahead and take our first brief break. When we get back, we're going to start getting into the meat of the book a little bit more. The book is The Historical Reliability of the Gospels. More information about later. I'm Nick Peters, and we'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Join
Join Army Girl for Christ and Minister Grock as they tackle some of today's pressing issues from a Christian point of view on Truth Be Told. Every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, check out CYIWorldwide.com.
My guest is Dr. Craig Blomberg, author of The Historical Reliability of the Gospels. I'm Nick Peters, and this is the Deeper Waters Podcast. If you want to call in and ask Dr. Blomberg a question about the Gospels, the number is 714-242-5180. Now, when we talk about the historical reliability of the Gospels, we need to be clear what we're talking about. Are we talking about inerrancy?
Not necessarily at all, no. I like to explain to audiences, and sometimes I even will bring two small caps with me, that I think of wearing different hats. I can wear my historian's hat, which does not begin with or in any way presuppose Christian faith, and I can examine any ancient text, or modern text for that matter, and ask the questions and use the methods that historians have established to try to determine where something can be corroborated, where there are questions about the reliability of data, and to begin to come to conclusions. If I do that, I think that I can make a very strong case for, as we were talking just before the break, the reliability of a large part of the Gospels. I've also written a book just on the Gospel of John. I think the historian can use the same tools and be much more confident about John's reliability than many in the academic guild would say today. But as long as I'm wearing my historian's hat, I will never prove the inerrancy of any ancient document, because the vast majority of all the information that it would take to corroborate something has been lost over the centuries. Inerrancy is a belief that is a theological belief that derives from the conviction, tracing the roots of the belief back to the very first Christians and Jewish people before them, with respect to what we call the Old Testament, that says these are books we believe were inspired by God, and if God, by the nature of what most people think of when they use that term, is someone who does not make mistakes, does not deceive people, does not lead one astray, then it makes sense to say that a book or collection of books that he inspired would be without error. But that's a sort of a top-down reasoning, theologically, and not what a historian does, and not what I'm doing in this book.
Well, if you don't mean inerrancy, then what exactly would you tell someone you mean by historical reliability?
That where the text can be tested, where we can use the standard criteria of historical research time and again, they prove to be trustworthy. And at some point, then the historian, and all historians of ancient works do this, begin to give a text the benefit of the doubt. If it has over and over again proved reliable where it can be tested, where it can't be tested, where it tells us something that we don't know about, we don't know anything else related to it from any other ancient source, we give it the benefit of the doubt. Just as the same can happen in reverse. If I find something that seems to be highly unreliable, I hesitate to use the example from classes, but I will. There are certain students who, unfortunately, over time, show a consistent carelessness about their work, and therefore, if I have someone in several classes and there's been no sign of any change, if I get another paper from that person, I confess to being somewhat suspicious as I start reading it. And that's what we do throughout life. So no, I'm not speaking of inerrancy, but I am speaking of, on historical grounds, strong degree of reliability where the Gospels can be tested.
I mean, historically, this is the exact same way we test most any document alongside the Gospels. That's in the same category. Now, I'm going to be assuming at this point, I'm guessing you agree that the Gospels are included as Greco-Roman biographies?
I would.
Okay. And so along with that, we'd have writings like Plutarch and such. And on just purely historical grounds, you'd have Tacitus and Josephus and others. And we don't want to approach Plutarch and Tacitus and expect them to be absolutely perfect. We realize it's quite likely they could make mistakes, but generally we have them as an innocent until proven guilty. This is just the way we treat our historical research, isn't it?
Yeah. Again, as I say, there are times when a particular author will demonstrate repeatedly that they are unreliable, and at some point with that individual, then whether a historian is conscious of it or not, they probably do shift to guilty until proven innocent, but that's not where we start.
It seems though that the Bible is often put in the category of guilty until proven innocent. There's this strange cliche idea that keeps going around that something in the Bible, in order for it to be seen as accurate, it must be corroborated by something outside the Bible. And
that's right.
I don't think we treat any other historical document that way.
No. I suppose someone who was a significant critic of the Quran and of the origins of Islam might take a similar approach if there is an ideology or a worldview or a world religion that someone, for whatever reason, very much dislikes or is prejudiced against or is afraid of, then possibly even subconsciously they can use a much more stringent standard with those documents than they do with others. More benignly, there are plenty of people who would probably have just bought into the argument that says, well, yes, the Gospels are Greco-Roman biography, the Book of Acts fits into the category of ancient historiography, but because they are also theological, because they are also intending to commend a certain religious collection of beliefs, therefore we treat them differently than, say, the histories of Josephus or Tacitus or the biographies of Plutarch or Arian or other Greco-Roman writers. And at first blush, that sounds like a reasonable argument until you do some study and realize that no ancient author writing any form of history or biography wrote without an ideological perspective that he wanted to commend. The modern concept of creating something like a congressional record of everything anybody ever said in a certain context would have blown ancient people's minds. They would have said, what possible purpose could there be for all of that? Sort of like somebody who blogs about every last minor detail that happened to them in a given day. Maybe their mother enjoys reading about it, but spare the rest of us, please.
Yeah,
everyone wrote with a perspective, and so you have to take that into account when you read ancient historians. You have to take it into account when you read the Gospels, but that doesn't mean you begin with an inherent position of suspicion.
Yeah, I recently had someone give me a gift certificate to a Christian bookstore, and I went in. The purchase I decided to make was a book by Eric Metaxas called Seven Men, and it's pretty much biographies of seven people and how they made it through life. And even if he doesn't say it outright, because I haven't read it yet, honestly, but I've had a lot of friends commend it and family, but it's not the case that Metaxas just sat down and said, yeah, I'll pick out seven people and I'll write about them. He wrote about them so that we who read it would look at him and say, that's the kind of person I need to be like. and be like that person. And that's why Plutarch wrote, and Tacitus and Josephus would write, so we could learn from the history. And so everyone did write where they have an agenda. Even if the agenda was just to entertain, like with a play, there could still be valuable lessons in there.
That's exactly right.
Now, when you start talking to Christians about what you do, about studying the historical Jesus, do a lot of them seem to at times get defensive, as if that's something that you shouldn't be doing, that we're supposed to take this by faith instead?
Not in the circles that I run in. There certainly is a more fundamentalist or extremely conservative wing of the church. I don't think nearly as large as it was a generation ago, but they certainly still exist, where that can raise concerns. And a lot of it is based on how you explain what you're doing. If you jump immediately to technical language that people don't use in modern day life, if you talk about biblical criticism, which is just a scholarly word for analysis, many people will hear, oh, what are you criticizing about the Bible, which some biblical critics do, but that's not the meaning of the concept in this context. And so a lot can be diffused up front just by your choice of words, how you explain in layperson's language what you're doing. And in my experience, especially in local churches with folks who are aware of the events of the world and social and cultural developments, there are so many things that happen, it seems, every couple of years to bring the question of the reliability of the Gospels into the public limelight. In just the last 10 years alone, we have seen the blockbuster book, The Da Vinci Code. We have seen the discovery and translation of the Gospel of Judas. We have seen the flurry of interest in a tomb in South Jerusalem that a few people tried to claim was the tomb of Jesus' family. Just last fall, there was the flurry of interest in a scrap of ancient manuscript that got labeled the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, and within days it was demonstrated to be a forgery, but that announcement was not broadcast nearly as widely as the original discovery. And so as long as these things keep appearing, most Christians who have any desire to share their faith and be taken seriously in the public square are very interested in what scholars are saying about the reliability of the Gospels.
And curiously enough, a lot of these things strangely come out around Easter time.
Or Christmas, yes.
And also I'd add in that now religion has really been brought into the public square in many ways from both sides. You get, for instance, the new atheists who have brought atheism to the public. And at the same time, on the other end, my wife and I spent, when it was on back in March, we watched the Bible miniseries on the History Channel. We quite enjoyed it. I didn't agree with it and everything, of course, but you know, at least we were out there talking about it.
Absolutely.
Now, when we were talking also about how, you know, you're not saying inerrancy, I am an inerrantist. I believe in inerrancy. I support inerrancy. At the same time, there can be a danger if we come to our studies and presuppose inerrancy. And I also think there's a danger if we marry Christianity to inerrancy. So it gets to a point where someone finds one thing they think is a contradiction in the Gospels. That means they throw the whole thing out. I mean, I've honestly had Christians tell me that if there's one contradiction in the Bible, then that means Christianity is a lie and Jesus didn't rise from the dead. And frankly, that terrifies me.
Yes. Well, and a tragic recent example of what can happen with that line of thinking is the scholar you alluded to a while back, Bart Ehrman, who teaches at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He was raised educationally for undergraduate and graduate schools at Moody Bible Institute and Wheaton Graduate School, solid conservative evangelical institutions, but imbibed from at least enough of his teachers in those contexts and perhaps other speakers, this all-or-nothing mentality that as he went into the art and science of textual criticism and started finding problems that he personally couldn't find convincing solutions to, he quickly fulfilled the prophecy of the doomsayers that he slid down the slippery slope all the way to agnosticism and does not consider himself any kind of a religious person today. Contrast that with so many other contexts worldwide. In this country, there is an organization with hundreds of biblical scholars that gather annually called the Institute of Biblical Research, who all profess Christian faith in all of the fundamentals that you would find in the ancient creeds, but some of them don't necessarily believe in inerrancy because there are a handful of problems that they feel haven't been adequately solved to their liking, and they have enough intellectual integrity not to claim to believe something stronger than they do believe. I praise God for the few hundred that fall into that category, because they've produced amazing scholarship, much of which has been faith bolstering. And if they had all become convinced that if you have one obscure problem somewhere that you might as well give it all up, then we'd be in desperate straits.
I'm also thinking that I listened to the Unbelievable podcast a lot, and we had Justin Browley on here a couple of weeks ago from there, and he had a Greer Christian episode once of Greering someone on the New Testament, and it was a teenager who had called in asking about the death of Judas in the New Testament, and saying, well, if you can't resolve this contradiction, how can you know anything in the Gospels is historically reliable? And I'm kind of sitting there, and it's kind of one of the things that I listen on my phone usually, and I'm going to throw my phone against the wall at that point, because I'm feeling, you know, you can actually go outside the Bible and realize some events did take place that are confirmed by extra-biblical evidence, such as the crucifixion of Jesus.
Right. And, I mean, even if you just think of a modern-day analogy, you have someone who is an excellent teacher in school. Let's say they're a history teacher. You don't assume they are inspired or inerrant, but you know that they've studied, they've done their homework, they work hard at being objective, and you learn all kinds of things from them that can be corroborated in books and in other sources. And one day your teacher simply makes a slip of the tongue and gives the wrong date or gives the wrong name or gives the wrong place for something. No one, to my knowledge, who's not in a mental hospital would from that moment onward say, oh my gosh, I can't believe anything this man will ever say to me again. yes, it's true. If the scripture were not inerrant, we would have to describe its relationship in a different way. And there have been all kinds of people who have done that over the years. They have used language of infallibility. They've used language of inspiration, of authority. They have used language of the text being a witness to the Word of God rather than being the Word of God itself. And like you, I think a good case can very much be made for an inerrancy, but I have countless friends who take one of those other views who are godly, active Christians, and to tarnish them all as philosopher I know who would lump all of those people together with the agnostic Bart Ehrman is ridiculous and damaging.
And, you know, I also think that for those of us who believe in the inerrancy of Scripture, we should approach these kinds of historical questions with the approach I have been and say, hey, bring it on. Because if the Bible is true, it's going to be able to withstand the test.
Of course, yeah. We want to have the public discussions.
Well, right now we're going to take a quick break, and there is something that could make people a bit cautious about the Gospels. We're going to be discussing that when we come back.
Oh, yeah. Hey, folks, it's Will ZPI, and you guys got to check out CYIWorldwide.com, home of the Grok Show, free MP3s, music, advice, and even prayer support. That, again, is CYIWorldwide.com. Check it out.
This is Mike Lacona. Nick Peters is my son-in-law, and I'm excited to announce his new podcast in which Nick will discuss and have guests on topics related to Christian apologetics and dealing with disabilities. Nick has already interviewed apologetic stars such as Greg Kokel and Rob Bowman, and I know of other stars he's in the process of inviting. So be sure to check out Nick's new podcast.
And we are back. My number is 714-242-5180. I am Nick Peters. My guest is Dr. Craig Blomberg. Now, we talked about how we should treat the Bible in more of an innocent until proven guilty. But if there's something that makes you think we should also be suspicious of this, it's those events that take place in the Bible called miracles. Dr. Blomberg, what are we to do with miracles?
Well, that's a huge topic, and I understand that you are having a guest on in the near future by the name of Craig Keener, who is quite an expert on that. But I can say a few things to perhaps whet some folks' appetite for that show. He has recently written a two-volume book simply called Miracles, in which he begins by applying the same historical criteria that you apply to any other claim to the ancient Christian testimonies of the miracles of Jesus and his first followers, but also to other stories from ancient rabbis, from Greek and Roman writers, because I think Christians have been guilty too often of somehow privileging the biblical miracles and saying, well, you believe these because they're in the Bible, but we won't believe any other stories because they're not in the Bible, and the unbelieving critic can see through that in a heartbeat if there is sufficient evidence for a miraculous event to have occurred in some other context. There's no theological reason that Christians should deny it. Miracles can be worked by God, miracles can be worked by the devil, and miracles can be manufactured up to a point by various human activities. So there are many possible sources. I think what is the real strength of Keener's book, however, is when he turns to the 20th and 21st centuries and has several hundred pages of the most documented events of every continent on the globe along the lines of instantaneous, permanent physical healings, casting out of demons, but even the occasional more dramatic miracle involving nature in some fashion, and on occasion, what appear to have been resurrections from the dead, where we have to look at the amount of testimony, the people involved, many of whom are still living. It begins to sound like what we read about in the New Testament itself. If someone is prepared to deny all of that testimony, then I would say they have greater faith than I have in believing the Christian story.
For those who are interested, he's talking about Craig Keener's book, and Craig Keener will be on here August 10th, so go ahead and mark your calendars if you're looking for that. And I've noticed in my interactions with skeptics that when they say they're skeptical of miracles, I now point straight to Craig Keener and say, have you read Miracles yet? Say, no, I'm not going to read Miracles. And it's always, just give me the one best miracle. No, you can't really do it that way. That seems so amazing that those who are the most skeptical of miracles don't really want to examine the biggest work against miracles, against their case to this date.
That's interesting. I have not had exactly that kind of conversation. I have certainly talked to people who come up with who are interested in give me an example, whether or not I think it's absolutely the clearest or best, and then they will try to come up with some contrary explanation. But it is difficult for me, and I do try to put my historian's hat on and not presuppose Christian faith, but it's hard for me to understand how over and over again, literally numbering in the thousands, we can have testimonies, not just in dark recesses of African jungles, but you can go online, you can go, for example, to YouTube and hear the story of a man in a South Florida hospital in recent years who was pronounced dead, who was being wrapped up and taken off to the morgue when the physician who had tried to resuscitate him longer than he almost ever tried, a good hour afterwards, had this overwhelming sense that God was telling him to go try again. And to the astonishment and against the protests of medical people, went back and prayed out loud, which offended one of the nurses who was attending, that God's will would be done in this instance, and applied the resuscitating device once again, and the man came back to life, and he had no brain damage, and there's no rational or scientific explanation for that. I don't know if that's the most dramatic example. I suspect it's not, but it's one that you can see, you can go online, you can examine it for yourself. This is something that didn't happen long ago or far away. I had the privilege earlier this spring of meeting Todd Burpo, who is the co-author of Heaven is for Real, and many listeners may be familiar with the story of his son Colton, who in the mid-2000s was not diagnosed when he had a ruptured appendix, living in rural Nebraska, and 5 days later, when they finally figured out what it was, his body was so filled with infection that he was shutting down, and he died on the operating table, except that he came back, and he came back with stories of having seen and heard what his father was saying in the waiting room, of having seen and heard what the doctors were saying when he was flatlined, and even more dramatically, of meeting Jesus, of meeting angels, of meeting his miscarried older sister who he never knew he had, of meeting a grandfather that he never knew he had, coming back and telling his parents about these things. If an atheist has an explanation for that, I'd like to hear it. And again, is that the most dramatic? I don't know. But there are thousands of such stories. Those have to be explained if you are going to explain away Christianity.
You know, I also think it's the point with what you said earlier about how we can often give a special favor to Christian miracles. I played the Mike Lacona promo a while ago, and he and I talk about these kinds of events regularly, as you can imagine. And he asked me once that, well, what do you think you'd say to Ehrman about someone like Apollonius, who's out there doing all these miracles and such? And I'd say, if there's good evidence for it, we should believe it. He's not going to lose any sleep over it. I mean, if Vespasian healed a blind man, he healed a blind man. What does that have to do with the resurrection of Jesus? If anything,
right.
Can I give a little bit more evidence?
One of the interesting things, on the other hand, though, is that if you go back to the ancient Greco-Roman world, not without exception, but in a substantial majority of cases, the closest parallels to accounts of New Testament miracles all come from the centuries after the first century. So it's possible that some of them are genuine. It's possible that some of them are made up independently of Christianity, but there is some evidence to suggest that the figure of Jesus was becoming widely enough known that people who wanted to support some other key figure, turn him into a wonder worker or magnify a historical core of what he already did, would deliberately try to paint him like the Christian incarnate God, Jesus of Nazareth, and that all has to be factored into the mix.
I've also heard, and I discussed this back in April, we had David Enstone Brewer as our guest one day. And he talked about how miracles would actually be seen as scandalous, much the way televangelists are today. And I heard that. I've been told that when the church fathers wanted to point to someone who was doing miracles as well, they had to go back in time to people like Pythagoras and Empedocles, because miracle claims weren't really held in high regard, so that the fact that the Bible includes them would be a way of saying, we can't deny Jesus did this. And then secondly, for you to comment also on, it's my understanding that none of his critics, including people like Celsus and others later on, ever denied Jesus did miracles.
Those are both very fascinating points, and you can make them even more strongly if you move into Jewish circles, because with the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 and all of the upheaval that caused for the rabbis and for Judaism of the day, miracles became played down simply because there were so many contexts where somebody had hoped for one and didn't get one. So that there are stories of the rabbis in the generations immediately after the beginning of Christianity appealing to miracles for winning a debate with a fellow sage or rabbi, and the retort is, miracle doesn't win the debate. You have to demonstrate it from the Torah, from the law, from the Holy Scriptures. So you're right. The Jews in the Talmud, on more than one occasion, this collection of once oral traditions that was eventually written down, refer to Jesus, and they refer to him as a sorcerer who led Israel astray. Well, a sorcerer was one who did magic, one who did miraculous deeds. Josephus, already in the late first century, speaks of Jesus as having done wondrous deeds. The term is actually paradoxa, from which we get our English word paradox. He couldn't explain them, but he didn't attempt to deny them. And the later Jewish writers didn't attempt to deny them. They just attributed Jesus' authority to the devil rather than to God. Well, if there was any significant doubt that Christ had worked these events, surely the simplest thing would have been to expose the Christian claims as false, but they didn't.
And in fact, even in Judaism, I think you only had one or two who were doing who were supposedly doing miracles, and these were exceptionally rare, like a Haniva circle drawer.
That's
and
right.
Others, it just wasn't common.
We know of two such individuals. He was one. And the reason he was called the circle drawer, according to the tradition, we don't know how historical it was, is that he would draw a circle around where he was standing in the dirt and pray fervently to God for whatever it was that he was asking, and say, "I am not leaving this circle until you answer my prayer." And the story goes that he did this once or twice in times of drought, praying for rain, and rain eventually came. Well, that's very similar to what we read about in the Old Testament with Elijah, but intriguingly, there's not a hint that Jesus ever did anything miraculous involving making it rain or making it stop raining. The closest you get is stilling a storm on the Sea of Galilee, but it's the wind and the waves that stop that the disciples marvel at, not anything about how much precipitation there was. And then the other man that the rabbis discussed is a man named Hanina ben Dosa, who does appear to have been able to work some miracles of healing. And yeah, that's fine. Jesus himself at one point said to some of his critics who had charged him with casting out demons by the power of the devil, and he said, "If I cast out demons by Beelzebub, then by whose power do your sons cast them out?" Acknowledging that there were other Jewish exorcists. There's no reason to imagine that God couldn't have wanted to free suffering people through other Jewish people in Jesus' time besides him.
And if we're talking about events that some deem supernatural, I like a Keener's term of superhuman better, these also show up even in the Greco-Roman biographies. I often tell people that they need to go and read Plutarch's biography of Brutus, and Brutus has a phantom appear to him and say, "You're going to die." These kinds of things weren't just in Christian Gospels, they were in other sources that we consider to be generally reliable.
That's right. If someone is absolutely convinced that those kinds of events can't happen, then they will bracket them, they will lay them to one side in reading other Greco-Roman historians, but they will not automatically discount or be suspicious of the prose narrative of normal events. So even for the person who says, "Sorry, I've listened to the arguments, I just can't come to grips with the supernatural," even that should not lead someone to discount the more ordinary parts, if you like, of Jesus' life.
Okay, then before we go to our next break, just wrap this question up on miracles of wondering. But if someone continues as Dr. Blomberg, "I'm just really skeptical when I begin my historical study of the Gospels because they have miracles. I mean, I'd like to believe this stuff, but it's really difficult for me. How do you suggest I approach this?"
In summary, approach it with an open mind. Don't discount the rest of the Gospels just based on the miracles, but then also immerse yourself in testimonies of modern-day miracles and see if at some point you don't say, "There is so much here that we don't understand, that science has not yet explained, that it is far too narrow and far too limiting to exclude the supernatural altogether.
Okay, we're going to be taking our next break. When we come back, we're going to get into the Gospels themselves a bit. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com. Hey, this is Minister Grok. Thanks for listening. Although Grok Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gift if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at CYIWorldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And before we get back to Dr. Blomberg, I would like to remind you all that this is listener-supported, and my own ministry, which exists as well independently, is supported by people like you. If you'd like to support Deeper Waters and what you're hearing here, please consider going to deeperwaters.wordpress.com. You can click the donate button there. You can also make donations through Ratio Christi. We've got a Facebook page. You can sign up for our newsletter. There are so many ways, and we really could use your support. But right now, we're talking with Dr. Craig Blomberg about the historical reliability of the Gospels. If you want to call in, the number is 714-242-5180. Now, you talked earlier, Dr. Blomberg, about criticism and how that's used to study the Gospels. Could you explain that a little bit more?
Right. We talked about the term. Probably the best analogy that that many folks would understand, especially if they've gone to a university or college, is we talk about the term literary criticism, which means the careful, thoughtful analysis and study of great works of literature in the various cultures of the world. And the term criticism certainly is related by etymology to words like critic and critique and criticize, but what a critic does by definition is a careful study of a work of art, a work of literature, a work of history, and analyzes perceived strengths and weaknesses. This can be done from the perspective of how reliable is something historically. This can be done from the perspective of how artistic is something in a literary or in an art context. And yes, in the case of a botched job, you can wind up with somebody criticizing something. But that's not inherently a part of what's going on. So biblical criticism, we'd best maybe in lay people's terms just say biblical analysis.
Okay, now there are several shades of biblical criticism, like source criticism, form criticism, redaction criticism. Could you give us a basic overview of the kinds of criticism that goes on?
With the Gospels, those three that you have mentioned have been foundational in the 19th and 20th centuries in the era of modern scholarship. Source criticism or analysis simply asks the question, what previously written sources, if any, did a Gospel writer use? When one compares particularly Matthew, Mark, and Luke, one finds enough parallelism in wording and in choice of information about Jesus' life and work that it's reasonable to assume, as was common among ancient historians and biographers, that Matthew, Mark, and Luke used other written sources preceding them, and that they themselves are interrelated in some way. The most common solution that scholars have come up with is that Mark wrote first, and that Matthew and Luke, in part, relied on Mark, but on other sources as well. Form criticism is not as obvious from its name in terms of what it studies. It does begin with the different literary forms that go into making up a gospel, forms of Jesus' teaching, like a parable, like a proverb, like a longer sermon, or different kinds of actions that he did, including miracles. And it recognizes that at times there are different principles of interpretation for different literary forms. But for questions about the reliability of the Bible, the more important part of form criticism is that it analyzes the period of oral tradition when these bits and pieces of the Gospels were passed along by word of mouth before anybody ever wrote any of them down, began to put them in collections, eventually full-fledged Gospels. And so it tries to come up with the most likely processes in the ancient world that would have been employed to pass things down by word of mouth and evaluate how reliably that would have functioned. And then the last one you mentioned, redaction criticism. Redaction is just a somewhat little-used English word that is a synonym for editing. We might say editorial analysis. Eventually, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, relying on those who had written before them, relying on what they had learned from oral tradition, Matthew, who himself was an apostle, Mark and Luke were not, obviously had his own memory to rely on as well, if we accept the tradition that he was the author of that gospel. Then they had to decide, out of all this possible information about Jesus, what are they going to include? Mm-hmm. What are they going to leave out? What are they going to stress? What are they going to mention very briefly? And that whole process of composition, of putting the gospel together, and the unique and distinctive emphases of each one is what we call redaction criticism.
Mm-hmm. And we have to realize definitely that this was done, that the gospels, contrary to what some might believe, didn't just fall straight from heaven. They were written by men who had to go and do their research, and we have to realize they use different stories. I mean, John tells us that if the whole world, if everything Jesus did was written, I suppose the whole world wouldn't contain enough room to hold all the books that would be written. And if we hold to inerrancy, we have to realize that Luke wrote about some events that Matthew didn't, Matthew wrote about some events that Luke didn't, etc., etc., that not one gospel contains everything.
And on top of all that, if we take the testimony of Scripture seriously, we have to turn to the opening four verses of the Gospel of Luke, in which I like to tell students, though you don't see the terms source, form, and redaction criticism, they're all hiding there in invisible ink, because this is what Luke says. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. He knows that there are written documents preceding him, and he appears to be aware of their contents. That's source criticism. Verse 2, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, the period of oral tradition. That's form criticism. Verses 3 and 4, with this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account, he put things in a certain order, for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. He had an ideological or theological purpose in putting this selection of events and teachings of Jesus together, and studying that is what redaction critics do. So despite the strange-sounding modern names, we're doing nothing but what Luke himself said went into the production of a gospel.
Now, in your book, you also talk about Midrash. Now, that's not a kind of criticism that's done today, but it is something important to study. What do you mean by Midrash?
I have to indulge your forgiveness if you're not a lover of puns, but my father and I were, and for many years when he was alive and I would use that term, he would ask me if I was talking about bumps on his tummy. But no, that's not what we're talking about with Midrash. That is a Hebrew word that simply means commentary. And there are a large number of ancient Hebrew commentaries on most of the books of the Old Testament that come from the first centuries of the Common Era, when Judaism and Christianity were running parallel. And they were known as Midrash, in the singular, Midrashim in the plural. But they were commentaries not as we might think of a commentary today that proceeds through a work of literature meticulously, section by section, line by line, explaining whatever the author thinks is important to note in the text that he's commenting on. The ancient Jewish Midrash was much more selective. It would start with a passage of Scripture, and if you flip through one of these documents translated into English, you will see that it follows selected passages of a book of the Bible sequentially, but it skips over a lot. And whatever the topic is that caught the writer's mind from a given passage can become a springboard to countless other texts of Scripture and homiletical reflections, much like, unfortunately, at times there are some Christian preachers who will have a text assigned to them to comment on, but the sermon may begin there, but by the time it ends, you can no longer figure out what the talk has to do with where you started.
Yep.
And so questions have been raised by different scholars if, because Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John frequently quote the Old Testament, either quoting Jesus himself or saying that something Jesus did fulfilled a certain part of the Old Testament, do they ever use any of the same kinds of techniques, some of which are quite normal and unobjectionable, some of which seem to be somewhat bizarre, that the ancient rabbis did in commenting on their scriptures? And different people give different answers, but I think in general there would be agreement that the New Testament writers are much, much more conservative in their use of the Hebrew scriptures than many of the rabbis were, and do not appear to use the most extreme and outlandish forms of interpretation that can sometimes be found in works like the Talmud and the Jewish literature.
Yeah, I've often said that if I want to point someone to a good example of a Midrashic book in the New Testament, I go to the book of Hebrews.
Yes. Yes, a letter that is chock full of quotations of the Old Testament and their exposition, and you can almost, some critics have put together an outline of Hebrews based on key Old Testament texts that they think form the basis of little mini sermons that together create what some have called a homily. The book of Hebrews as a whole has been likened to a sermon.
Yeah, but haven't some people said that Midrash is also a way of denying something as historical? For instance, hasn't been said that Robert Gundry was said to see Matthew 1 and 2 as Midrash.
Right. There is another way of using the term for a collection of books in the period in between the Old and New Testament that commented on Genesis, Exodus, some other historical parts of the Bible by retelling the same stories but adding a lot of detail that cannot be found in the scripture, leading to the to-date unanswerable question, did any of this preserve genuine historical tradition that was passed down for centuries? Is it all the product of the imagination of the Jewish writers? Is it some combination of the two? We have, again, if I can speak of modern-day preachers, we have people who will retell stories from the Bible, and because they know their audiences are familiar with them, add little details that will make the text come alive. What was somebody thinking? What was their emotion? What was the color of their clothing? Or they'll use a contemporization and create a little bit of humor by saying somebody pulled out his flashlight, when of course we know they didn't have flashlights back there. And modern congregations are not confused by this because they know the story. They may be following along with it in their Bibles, and then they hear the preachers inserting these little things, and they recognize it's just an imaginative way of trying to help the story come alive. Robert Gundry is a man who taught for most of his career at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California, had a very distinguished career of teaching and writing on a wide number of topics. His Survey of the New Testament is now, I think, in its fourth edition and has been used by countless undergraduates around the country. But in 1982, he published a commentary on Matthew that was a bit unique in its form by suggesting that Matthew did to Mark and to a certain degree to Luke as well what some of these intertestamental Jewish writers did to books like Genesis and Exodus, and therefore where Matthew has information that you don't find in any other gospel, and where Matthew seems to be using his distinctive vocabulary, perhaps his original readers recognized that he wasn't just telling them more actual history, but trying to help the story come alive a little bit, like other Jews of his day did. That became an extraordinarily controversial book, and interestingly, as far as I can tell, neither liberal nor conservative scholars, with just a handful of exceptions, really found his case convincing. But it did stir up a lot of controversy in its day.
Yeah, things that we should keep in mind is that when it comes to Midrash and history, it's not an either-or thing.
Right.
I remember telling someone that I think when you read the opening chapters of Matthew, you have the birth of Jesus. He goes to Egypt. Then he's called out of Egypt. He goes through the Red Sea in his baptism. It's not the exact Red Sea, but it's a parallel. And then he goes into a wilderness where he's tempted. After that, he goes up on the mountain and delivers the law. And well, that's the history of Israel right there. And Matthew is showing that Jesus is a true Israel. And why can't he take historical events and arrange them in a way to show Jews that their history is being redone in Jesus, that it's a both and?
And now you're giving an example of a third way that the term Midrash is sometimes used, where it might be better to use a term like typology. A type was an event that was significant in the history of Israel that New Testament writers saw striking parallels in the life of Jesus, and they called attention to these. They weren't necessarily predictive prophecies being fulfilled. Matthew 2:15 quotes, "Out of Egypt I've called my son," from the first verse of Hosea 11. But if you read Hosea 11, the prophet is talking in the past tense. He's not making a future prediction. He says, "Out of Egypt I have called my son," and it's clear that he's referring to the nation of Israel, who collectively were called out of Egypt at the time of the Exodus. So what is Matthew doing saying that that is fulfilled in the baby Jesus with his parents having to flee to Egypt and then later return to Israel? It's typology pure and simple. The monotheistic believing Jew hearing this story about baby Jesus would at the very least be caught up short. What are the odds, if God is not in this, that when our covenant was first established with Moses at the giving of the law, we were languishing in slavery in Egypt and were brought out of Egypt into the promised land, and now these fledgling Christians are saying that their founder, the one they believe is our Jewish Messiah, came to Israel out of Egypt under extraordinary circumstances. If I'm a believing Jew, not yet even following Jesus, at the very least, I have to say that's a remarkable coincidence. Maybe that's a sign of God's providential hand at work. Maybe that's a reason for believing in this man as Messiah.
Well, we'll be back to discuss a little bit more after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com. Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com. Home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
And I'm Nick Peters. We are back to the Deeper Waters podcast. Our number is 714-242-5180. Our guest is Dr. Craig Blomberg. Now, we've been talking about the historical reliability of the Gospels. So after discussing all the ways the Bible has been studied over and over, and especially the Gospels, Dr. Blomberg, what is the case then for saying the Gospels are historically reliable?
Right, which is a very polite way of saying, could you summarize your multi-hundred-page book in a simple sentence or two? And the answer is no, I don't think I can boil it down quite that much, but I can at least list the kinds of areas that that people should consider. We have manuscripts that have as early and strong attestation, far more, in fact, than for any other work of antiquity. We have authors who wrote from a position in which they would have known what had happened and at an early enough date that hostile eyewitnesses were still around who could have debunked their story if they erred in any significant way. We have them writing in books, as we've discussed before, whose literary genre most closely resembles that of the other most reliable historians and biographers of the ancient world. We have an oral, largely oral culture that was committed to prodigious feats of memorization and care in the preservation and transmission of epic narratives that they believed were sacred, and that's not just in Jewish circles. Large numbers of Greek school children had large parts of the Iliad and Odyssey of Homer committed to memory, each of which is about 100,000 words in length. The longest gospel is not even 20,000 words in length. We've not yet talked about issues like what other ancient non-Christian sources say, or archaeological confirmation of the kinds of things that, that archaeological digs can be relevant for. We could add issues such as the numerous awkward and embarrassing features in the Gospels that one would have expected somebody trying to put only the best face of a new movement forward would have ignored or at least toned down. We can talk about topics or issues that appear nowhere in the Gospels but were huge debates in the first generation of Christianity, like whether a Gentile had to be circumcised in order to become a Christian. What about the gifts of prophecy and their interpretation, and tongues and its interpretation? And if the gospel writers, as so many have charged, felt free at times simply to invent things about Jesus in order to address debates of their day, then it's surprising that we find absolutely nothing addressing these issues. So there's a potluck of possibilities, any one of which could launch us into our next conversation, but those are the kinds of things that the book addresses in considerable detail.
And this is why, listeners, we have 2 hours to interview our guest, usually, because there are so many questions we can't possibly address everything. And if you're seeing everything where I wish you'd address what I'm interested in, well, call us up. The number is 714-242-5180. But let's start looking at some of these things. For the manuscript evidence, I'll say that I am working on getting Dan Wallace on later on. And so I think he'll be able to handle the textual questions there. But let's go to some of the things you were talking about, like extra-biblical evidence. I have that on my list of things we could discuss. Is there, I mean, I already know the answer to this, but is there anything outside the Bible that does confirm the Bible?
Yes, very much so. Again, if we're just limiting ourselves to the Gospels, and the simpler topic to address is there literature from the ancient world, whether Jewish, Greek, or Roman, but not written by a Christian author that makes reference to Jesus or makes reference to the events, the people that we find in the pages of the four Gospels. An outstanding book for anybody who might want to see all that evidence laid out in great detail is written by a man named Robert Van Voorst, V-O-O-R-S-T, called Jesus Outside the New Testament. And writers such as Josephus, such as Tacitus and Suetonius, such as Thallus, Lucian, and collections of Jewish traditions like the Talmud, all contribute to what if we create one giant composite, brief account of what we know about Jesus from non-Christian sources might run like this. He was a Jew who lived in the first third of the first century in Israel. He was born out of wedlock. He, as an adult, had a ministry that intersected with that of someone by the name of John, who baptized a lot of folks. He had a brother named James. He was a teacher in Israel who gathered disciples to himself, like rabbis often did. Five of them are named. He frequently got into conflict with the religious authorities of his day, particularly over interpretations of the law. A couple examples are given. And as a result, he eventually was executed by crucifixion during the governorship of Pontius Pilate in Judea, which limits the time period to AD 26 to 36. And yet, despite that ignominious death, was believed by his followers to have been the Messiah, the one prophesied to come and liberate Israel, was believed to have worked wondrous feats, miracles, if you like, and even to have appeared to his followers raised from the dead. Whether or not anyone believes that, the non-Christian testimony goes on to say that the movement of his followers has continued to grow decade by decade, and very quickly his followers began singing hymns to him in their worship services as if he were some kind of a god. Now, that's not a narrative that's nearly as long as any one of the Gospels. It would take me about an hour and a quarter to read the Gospel of Mark out loud, and I talk very rapidly. But that still is a whole lot more than what you would suspect from some writers and a lot of people in the blog world who just make blatantly false claims like, well, there is no evidence for Jesus outside of Christian sources. Not at all true.
I was going to ask you what you think about these people who go around, you know, such as Christ mythos. I mean, I even saw someone on an article Gary Habermas wrote, someone who commented on it on around Easter time, said that even Albert Schweitzer knew there was no historical Jesus. And I was just kind of banging my head against the keyboard right then.
Yes. It's hard to refute arguments that simply falsify entire disciplines of historical knowledge without any warrant, other than to say, sorry, that's not right.
No, when we come to the Gospels, also there are some people who would say the Gospels shouldn't be trusted because they're not very first-hand accounts. They're more hearsay than anything else. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, there are two ways to answer that, and one of those can be subdivided into two parts. If you accept the testimony of the unanimous testimony of the earliest centuries of Christians that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were written by people who bore those names, with Matthew being a converted tax collector and one of Jesus' 12 apostles, and John being one of the inner three of the leaders of his apostles and the disciple that Jesus particularly loved, then we have two of the four writers who very much were eyewitnesses of a large part of Jesus' ministry. On the other hand, Mark is the John Mark who was a companion of both Paul and Peter, but we don't know necessarily that he was a follower of Jesus or an eyewitness to anything in the gospel that bears his name, but there is significant early Christian testimony that he learned much of what he wrote from the Apostle Peter. So that's not firsthand, it's secondhand, but it's far more than hearsay. It's talking to a key leader who was there from the start. Luke, we already mentioned, writes in his opening verses that he interviewed those who were from the first eyewitnesses. But he was not. Almost certainly he was not. He is most likely a Gentile who came to faith outside of Israel, perhaps in Greece, and who became Paul's beloved physician, to use the language of the King James Version, his favorite doctor, and accompanied him on part of his missionary travels, including that period of time when Paul was imprisoned in Judea, probably between the years of 57 and 59 in the first century, with Jesus having been crucified probably in 30, so less than 30 years after the fact, when there still would have been eyewitnesses of Jesus' life living, and Luke would have had a couple of years to leisurely meet as many of them and interview as many of them as he could. So that's the way I would answer the question, with Matthew and John, the one part of the answer being eyewitnesses themselves, Mark and Luke, the other part of the answer to the question being those who spent a lot of time with eyewitnesses. Now, many modern scholars, for a variety of reasons, think that those are not the original authors. We can get into that debate if you're interested. But what I would say is, even if we accept that for the sake of argument, the general consensus in more liberal circles is that Mark was written probably in the early 70s, Matthew and Luke in the 80s, John in the 90s. Conservatives would often want to push some of those dates earlier, but for the sake of argument, let's take those dates. Even then, we are talking about a 40 to 60 year period of time from the events described. There are almost no ancient histories or biographies that we have from the Middle East or the Roman world of anyone written that close in time to the people they write about. And yet, we're back to the double standard that you talked about earlier.
Yep.
Ancient historians can put together large sections of biographies of Alexander the Great, who died in 323 BC, and the earliest existing biographies we have of him come from the late 1st century AD. So in comparison, what we have for the life of Jesus is extraordinarily good in a world that was used to memorizing and faithfully passing on traditions that it deemed sacred and valuable.
And since you've talked about archaeology, I think it's interesting that you mentioned Luke would be the one who'd be most likely to be closest to hearsay, since we don't exactly know who the witnesses were that he interviewed. But archaeology has shown time and time again that Luke, and especially in case of Acts, has been a first-rate historian who dots every I and crosses every T.
Yes. Wish we had dots and crosses in the Greek letters to turn that into his ancient writing, but there are large volumes of detailed scholarship that people can turn to. One can go almost paragraph by Colin Hemer's book, The Book of Acts in its setting in Hellenistic history, is an excellent one. And we spoke earlier about Craig Keener, who is writing what will be a massive four-volume commentary on Acts. Volume 1 is out. Volume 2 and 3 are advertised as coming out later this year. We'll see if that actually happens. Here is a man who has studied the ancient sources more than perhaps any living scholar. And you can spend months in combing through all of the cities and ruins of cities that the first apostles traveled through, and finding detail after detail that corresponds to what we know, people's names, places, topography, the lay of the land, customs that were unique to one city that wouldn't have applied someplace else. practices, Roman laws that were in place for a limited number of years that weren't known previously or later. And over and over and over again, Luke gets it exactly right.
We're going to take our final break, come back, and we'll be wrapping everything up. I'm Nick Peters here, and this is the Deeper Waters Podcast. Our special guest today is Dr. Craig Blomberg. We'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You could send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
This is Mike Lacona. Nick Peters is my son-in-law, and I'm excited to announce his new podcast in which Nick will discuss and have guests on topics related to Christian apologetics and dealing with disabilities. Nick has already interviewed apologetic stars such as Greg Kokel and Rob Bowman, and I know of other stars he's in the process of inviting. So be sure to check out Nick's new podcast.
And speaking of Mike Lacona, if all goes well, I mean, there's been some recent developments that could delay him, but if all goes well, Mike Lacona will be our guest next week on the Deeper Waters podcast. We're really looking forward to that episode. Right now, we've got Craig Blomberg with us, and we're really enjoying that one as well. And we're talking about the historical reliability of the Gospels. Now, what about contradictions, though? Because if you go to most any atheist website today, you'll find a litany of biblical contradictions. What are we to make of these?
Well, which one would you like to start with?
Well, let's consider, for instance, start with one that could be fairly simple. Okay, the centurion that heals his servant. Did the centurion come to Jesus, or did his servants come to Jesus?
I would assume that his servants came. You are thinking about the passage that appears in both Matthew 8 and Luke 7, and
yep.
There are details that are common to both that make it pretty clear that this is the same episode that takes place in the vicinity of Capernaum. It's not one of those problems that we can deal with by saying, well, these really aren't true parallels. They're separate events. There are fascinating differences as well as numerous points of agreement between the two passages, but probably the most striking is the one that you have highlighted. Luke, interestingly, is the one gospel writer out of particularly out of the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, who paints the Jewish leaders in, at times, quite a reasonable light. Matthew is pretty unrelentingly negative in what he chooses to include about them and their growing conflict with Jesus. So it's probably not surprising that he leaves out the reference to the sending of some of the Jewish elders who then bear witness that this is a man worthy to have a favor done for him, and he's helped to build our synagogue and so forth. But then you still have to come up against the observation you made that Matthew appears to say flat out that the centurion came, where Luke says that he sent an embassy of some of his fans, as we might call them today. I like to use the analogy from the world of presidential politics. It's quite common to hear or read in a news report that the president today announced that, fill in the blank with whatever the announcement is about, and if you were to research the issue, you might discover that it was his press secretary who gave a news release, and that it was a speechwriter who crafted the announcement. And one would hope that somewhere along the way the president did actually see it and approve it, but it's neither his own wording nor does it come from his mouth. But that's conventional language. We understand that. Nobody that I'm aware of would, in their right mind at least, charge a news report that said the president today announced such and such with having aired. The same thing is true in the ancient world. It was extremely common to speak about someone doing something, acting through one of their underlings, if you like. Later, we learned that Pilate, if you translate the Greek literally, flogged Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Pilate would never have, no self-respecting governor would ever have picked up a whip. That was something left to the soldiers that he commanded. And so most modern translations will say something like, Pilate had Jesus flogged, because that's exactly what would have taken place. This was conventional language, and everybody understood it.
The passage you're talking about is John 19:1. In fact, I was looking it up just as an example to use. And I think most contradictions, as are so-called, are really simple kind of things to work out, like this. Maybe something else also as an example would be to talk about the baptism of Jesus. There's some parts where it will say, you are my son with whom I am well pleased. And another will say, this is my son with whom I am well pleased. One speaking third person, one speaking second person. What do we do with those?
Right. And I really was, I was not expecting you when I said a minute ago which one would you like to start with to so readily accede to my request. I said that because in many conversations that I've had with people who say, well, what do you do about all of the contradictions in the Gospels? When I say, well, which one would you like to start with, they have to admit they don't actually know what a contradiction is or which one of these is. And so I was perhaps being inappropriately playful at that point. Yeah, there are things that can be said that will cover an awful lot of the items on some of these lengthy lists on blog sites. The actual number of semi-difficult passages, which I tried to discuss in one of the chapters in the book, are maybe anywhere from a dozen to 20 in number. It's not as if there's something, the hundreds that I've seen people claim in various websites. The vast majority of the differences among gospel parallels simply reflect the nature of ancient history writing. This was a world that did not have quotation marks. It did not have any symbol or any way of flagging when someone's direct speech was beginning, nor did it have any felt need for them. And so when a writer in ancient Hebrew or Greek or Latin said, so-and-so said, what follows could very well be a paraphrase. It could be an abbreviation. It could be an explanatory clarification of someone's words, as long as they were faithful to what that writer meant. Daryl Bach at Dallas Seminary likes to talk about being faithful to the gist of what someone said. Now, you certainly could falsify a person's claims. You could put a spin on it that they did not intend. There are definitely limits to this enterprise, but to envision one gospel writer addressing his audience, or imagining God addressing Jesus' audience by saying, this is my beloved son, and yet recognizing that God was likewise speaking directly and personally to Christ himself. And so another gospel writer saying, "You are my beloved son," is well within the range of paraphrase that was common and completely acceptable in the ancient world. If we generalize from there and talk about how Matthew and Luke used Mark, we were mentioning a while back, comparing parallel accounts, we see that sometimes they abbreviate, they select, they explain, they clarify, sometimes they expand, sometimes each is narrating separate parts of a much fuller account that included both sets of details. A sizable number of the so-called discrepancies among the Gospels are nothing more than this, and a fair number of what remain are what I mentioned a moment ago. Sometimes, frequently perhaps, Jesus repeated himself. A good itinerant teacher regularly says similar things on many different occasions, and some of his miracles bore a resemblance to one another. We forget in a world without modern medicine how many people at any given time in any ancient community were sick, some of them chronically ill. And so to have multiple accounts of blind people who received their sight, or disabled people who were made able to walk, even down to some of the similar recurring details about their afflictions, that might be striking to modern people, but not in the ancient world. Such people were everywhere. And so the first thing we need to do when somebody talks about contradictions among parallels is make sure they are genuine parallels. Now, I will never try to solve some of the differences between the accounts of Jesus' Last Supper by saying Jesus had more than one Last Supper. I think that would be a contradiction.
Or Jesus had more than one crucifixion.
Exactly. Or what I'm sure is an apocryphal story about someone from a religion who believed in reincarnation, who was invited to read a New Testament, and by the time they got to the Gospel of John, went back to the friend who had invited them to read it and said, "Why did Jesus have to live four times?"
I must admit, when you did tell me the which contradiction would you like to start with, it's probably my Aspie side that says, okay, he's literally asking me for a contradiction. I'll think of something. I actually had to think for a little while, because I hear some of them so often that kind of most of them have been, that's hardly a contradiction at all. But I think
you rose to the occasion very well.
I think you probably agree that most what needs to be done by a lot of these atheist websites and such is something that's usually not done too often, and that would be go to your local seminary or university, get out a few commentaries, get out a few books, and just do some study on it. I mean, if then you think it's a contradiction, okay, but you can make more of an informed point than just saying, this says X, this says Y, contradiction.
Right, and to make and reinforce the point you made so well earlier, people don't go around doing this with Arian and Plutarch's respective biographies of Alexander the Great. In fact, classical historians have seen all kinds of discrepancies among those accounts, and while in some cases they conclude that there are simple errors, in many cases they have found very plausible ways to say, no, what at first glance looks like a contradiction is not at all. And if one can do that with Alexander, if one can do that, an excellent example is the writings of Josephus, because he himself gave two different accounts of the period of Jewish history leading up to and including the war with Jerusalem in AD 70. One is much briefer because it's part of his 20 volumes of biblical antiquities, and one is much more extensive because it is a work just on the Jewish war itself. He doesn't even include the same details or tell things the same way from one book to the next, and yet we assume he doesn't think that he was contradicting himself. And on closer inspection, there are often very plausible ways of seeing that he wasn't. But nobody bothers to put up websites about Josephus, because obviously the stakes aren't nearly as high. The reason Christianity gets attacked so much is because if it's true, then those who are attacking it have an awful lot to lose. But they also have an awful lot to gain by becoming his followers. Why would someone not want to live forever in the splendor and glory and earthly and universal transformation that the last two books of the New Testament and Revelation talk about, when it is a free gift that can be received simply by becoming a follower of Jesus? There has to be something going on much more than objective analysis of history, and I suspect that in many cases it has to do with the human propensity to want to live our lives our way, to be our own masters, to submit to no one, no matter how good the results are that are promised, no matter how awful the alternatives are that are warned against. To borrow Frank Sinatra's song from a generation ago, we want to do things our way. To hell with the consequences. Pardon my French.
The book is The Historical Reliability of the Gospels. Where would you suggest people go to if they want to get a copy of that book?
Any way they get copies of other books. It's published by University Press. You can order it from their website. You can go to Amazon. You can go to those increasingly rare live hard copy bookstores that still exist. It is now in its second edition, having been revised in 2007. It's still pretty up to date, and I hope that that folks will find benefit from it.
I've got right here on Amazon for all interested. It's $16.89. Unfortunately, it's not on Kindle yet. That could hopefully be coming out in the future. And in our emails, you said you have another book that's in the works, right?
At the moment, I'm always working on way too many projects at once, but the one I mentioned to you that is at the front of the tarmac, getting ready to be take off into the air, is a book called Christians in an Age of Wealth, a biblical theology of stewardship that is being published by Zondervan and hopefully will be out by September.
And we've talked, in fact, about where Amazon listed as November right now, but we've talked about when that book comes out, having you come back on and discussing with another Christian scholar, and maybe sometimes debating and such, getting different viewpoints on a Christian view of economic theory. So just let people know that that could be something in the works. We've got about 2 minutes left right now, so I want to give up any final thoughts you'd like to say concerning the historical reliability of the Gospels.
For those who may have just started listening recently, obviously I think a very strong case can be made. I can't begin to summarize all the terrain that we've covered, but maybe my parting exhortation to anybody, whether they're a Christian or not, would be the next time some sensational new claim hits the news, whatever it is, about some part of the Gospels, the life of Jesus, or elsewhere in the Bible, realize that there is very little new under the sun, that almost all of the questions that people have raised about the credibility of Scripture have been raised before, Detailed answers have been given, and they may or may not be convincing, but if someone is claiming that there is something brand new that puts everything about Christianity in a radically new light, my advice would be very suspicious and watch to see what happens. The true valid scholarship will take weeks, if not months, to unfold and come to responsible conclusions. So whatever anybody says on the first day or the first week that something makes the news is very provisional, very tentative. It's not exciting to say this, but take your time, form your opinion slowly, watch and see what happens.
And I'm Nick Peters, and we thank Dr. Blomberg for coming on, and we are signing off now of the Deeper Waters podcast.
Thank you very much.